From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And Metropolitan Police in London are identifying the man they say is responsible for yesterday's attacks outside Parliament as Khaled Massoud, 52 years old, born in Britain. We're also learning that one of the three killed in the attack was American. The Mormon Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, released a statement saying he was Kurt Cochran. His wife was also injured in the attack. They were in London as part of a trip to celebrate their 25th wedding anniversary. ISIS has claimed responsibility for the attack. The attacker was shot and killed by police. Prime Minister Theresa May told the House of Commons today the man had once been investigated by the British authorities for possible ties to extremism.
He was not part of the current intelligence picture. There was no prior intelligence of his intent or of the plot. Intensive investigations continue.
The BBC's Rob Watson joins us in London. Rob, what more do we know about this man and why he was investigated earlier?
Not a great deal, Robin, and hello to everybody from London. Yes, as you say, he was 52 years old. I mean, he seems to be one of these characters who has been on the police radar, not so much for terrorism activities or for carrying out or being involved with extremism, but really for violence. Fairly, I guess, what you might call petty violence. So he's had several convictions for criminal damage. He'd been convicted for possession of a knife in 2003, but he's never been convicted of any terrorism offences.
Well, we know that there were raids. Other people were arrested. Do we know why?
Yes, I think we do. I mean, I think these are thought to be close associates of his. And I think the reason why they've been brought in is that the police think that Khaled Massoud was basically acting alone. He may have been inspired by Islamic State, but that he was acting alone. And I think they just want to check that out by arresting some of his closest associates and testing out that theory.
Now, well, Rob, you made a point of saying hello from London, and we want to say to you, our thoughts are with everyone in London. What's the mood there? Especially, I mean, there's a little bit of a controversy. After the attack, Donald Trump Jr., the president's son, tweeted, "You have to be kidding me. Terror attacks are part of living in a big city," says London Mayor Sadiq Khan. Now, this included a link to a 2016 interview in which Mayor Khan said that the threat of terror attacks are part and parcel of living in a big city, so people have to be vigilant. He was talking about being vigilant, not just kind of accepting them. What's been the response to the tweets from Donald Trump seeming to say that this Muslim mayor was saying we don't have to pay attention to them?
Unless there's something wrong with my Twitter feed, Robin, I think it's one of those Twitter storms, as we call them in the UK. I've forgotten what the phrase is for them in the United States, that doesn't really seem to have got going. I mean, I think maybe because it's not, maybe because it's about what's happened, maybe there's just too much else going on, but it hasn't really caught fire. I mean, it's certainly the case whenever you get an attack like this, you get, I mean, I'm putting this crudely, of course, Robin, but there is a sort of debate on Twitter and social media in Britain, as there would be in other countries, about things like multiculturalism, with some people immediately taking to Twitter to say, this just shows you that we haven't got it right, that Muslims aren't properly integrated. And then you also get others from a more liberal tradition saying, you know, the most important thing when you have an attack like this is to think rather than to react.
Yeah. How are people reacting? I mean, this is not the first attack. How are people today?
No, you're right. And I mean, certainly for anyone who's over about, over about 40, London, of course, had gone through a long period of dealing with violence directed at it from the IRA, actions related to the situation in Northern Ireland. Of course, we've had attacks before on the London Underground in 2005. So, I mean, look, one always feels a bit funny about saying this, but I think most people, they sort of take the attitude, God, it's terrible, but the chances of it happening to me aren't very much. So I think it's true that people maybe they look more suspiciously at people that they think might be Muslim. I mean, let's face it, let's get that out in the open on public transport. But I think most people, they just sort of plod on with their lives and think, goodness, that was awful. Well, but probably won't be me.
But Rob, are there any questions about how this man was able to get so close to Parliament? I mean, thankfully he had a knife and not a gun and got so close. Is there thinking about maybe putting up barriers or something?
Well, there is, of course, a discussion has started about security. The place where it happened is just about the only part of Parliament where you could get in without a kind of what you would understand by a normal barrier. And that's because it's where people like me go. I've got a bicycle and a parliamentary pass, so I can just go in there. It's where MPs take their cars in and other people can walk in with parliamentary passes. And the arguments amongst from people who say, look, actually, there's no need to change security very much, is that he didn't get more than 20 yards before being shot dead.
Yeah. Well, the BBC's Rob Watson there in London. And Rob, thank you. And again, thoughts with you.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you, Robin.
Well, if all goes according to plan, there will be a vote in the House of Representatives tonight on the Republican plan to replace Obamacare. But at the moment, it is unclear if Republicans have the votes to pass it. Members of the conservative House Freedom Caucus are opposing the bill, saying that it doesn't go far enough in repealing major provisions of the Affordable Care Act. So the president has been working the phones and could be ready to make major concessions to get Freedom Caucus votes. Joining us is NPR health policy correspondent Allison Kojak. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Jeremy.
And in order to win over the most conservative House members, Republicans are considering eliminating what are called essential health benefits, which are required under the Affordable Care Act. Give us a sense of what those are, what those essential benefits cover, and why they're in play now.
Well, there are 10 categories of essential health benefits written into the Affordable Care Act. They're everything from doctor visits to emergency room care to maternity and childbirth and mental health care. And it essentially says if you're going to offer insurance, something you as a company call health insurance, it has to cover all of these things to some degree or another.
So if they were to take away that list of things, which also, by the way, includes prescription drugs,
exactly.
If they were to take away that list, what good would insurance be?
Well, I think that's the major question. There's been a big push among Republicans to talking about why do I, as a man, have to pay for maternity care or blah, 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 blah. And so that has become sort of the bugaboo here. But really, these are a broad array of coverages that most people think should be included. If they're going to buy health insurance, they think that it's going to cover something. So Republicans are looking to sort of thin this list out to a degree so that insurance premiums will be lower and more people will buy policies. They say that this list is too comprehensive and makes insurance too expensive for healthy people.
But it's been pointed out that if you were to remove this list of essential health benefits, then the ban on excluding people with pre-existing conditions, which they are at this point planning to keep in the Republican plan, becomes sort of meaningless, because if you have a pre-existing condition and you can't get all of these things covered, you're going to spend a fortune.
Yeah, what's the point? I've been writing about that today, actually. And, you know, I've been talking to experts from both sides, Republican and Democrat, and they do acknowledge that, you know, if you have coverage for pre-existing conditions and your pre-existing condition is schizophrenia, buying a health insurance policy that doesn't cover mental health care doesn't do you any good. You know, and the idea or the fear is that insurance companies will stop offering policies that cover certain kinds of expensive care.
So if this list of essential health benefits is removed, is it going to be harder for some moderate Republicans in the House to support this bill?
Yes, and we've been seeing that already happen. Some people this bill, revised bill, has not come out yet. So we don't really know exactly what we're talking about. But there have been a few moderate Republicans just today who've come out and said, I'm not going to support it if it doesn't have these essential health benefits, or at least some degree of them, because they know people who have chronic health conditions. They might have them their own. They have family members who have chronic health conditions and need coverage.
Interestingly, the network of political action groups funded by the conservatives Charles and David Koch, the Koch brothers, said that they would give financial support to conservatives who oppose this bill. Why are they against it?
They are more on the side of the very conservative Republicans who would like to see the Affordable Care Act repealed altogether. Charles and David Koch are essentially libertarians. They don't want to see the government deep in people's business. And they also prefer markets to take care of things. So they have pledged what they say is seven figures, somewhere in the millions of dollars, in order to challenge Republican members of Congress who vote for this bill because they think it preserves too much of the Affordable Care Act.
So, Allison, do Republicans have enough votes to pass this?
At this point, they do not, and they're going in the wrong direction right now. Of course, this, again, like I said, we don't know exactly what we're talking about. So whatever changes they come up with today may bring more people in, but we don't know how many people they'll bring out. Right now, it seems like they're about 20 or 30 votes short.
And they are still planning to hold a vote tonight.
That's the word, but we haven't seen the bill. And there are people right now, Paul Ryan has asked for an exemption to allow them to vote on a bill that hasn't been made public a few days in advance, which is generally what the House rules require. So we'll see how that plays out throughout the afternoon and early evening.
And just briefly, is Paul Ryan's speakership in question if this goes down?
I'm not sure if it's that stark, but it's definitely a test of his leadership. This is one of the major things that he, President Trump, and pretty much every Republican in Congress has campaigned on. And if he can't get it through, that's a big problem.
That's Allison Kojak, NPR health policy correspondent. We'll be watching. Allison, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Democrats said today they plan to filibuster Judge Neil Gorsuch's nomination to the Supreme Court. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer made that announcement today on the Senate floor.
After careful deliberation, I have concluded that I cannot support Judge Neil Gorsuch's nomination to the Supreme Court. He will have to earn 60 votes for confirmation. My vote will be no, and I urge my colleagues to do the same.
Today is day four of Gorsuch's confirmation hearings. The Senate Judiciary Committee is hearing testimony about Gorsuch from former colleagues, lawyers, and advocacy groups. Gorsuch finished his own 2 days of testimony yesterday, and we want to listen now to some extended clips. One of the issues that came up again and again was the Democrats' anger over the fact that Republicans refused to give a hearing to President Obama's nominee for the same seat, Merrick Garland. Here's Vermont Democrat Patrick Leahy.
I think it was shameful. I think it has severely damaged the reputation of this committee. I think it has severely damaged the reputation of senators who concurred with that. We were anything but the conscience of the nation in that regard. And those who proudly held their hand up to this and swore that they would uphold the Constitution of the United States did not.
Generally, Gorsuch's 2 days of testimony were civil and uneventful, though two of his former law students did make waves the night before the hearing started with letters they sent to the committee. Democratic Senator Dick Durbin asked Gorsuch about the students' concerns, which arose out of a discussion that he had led in a legal ethics and professionalism class.
It was a gender-targeted discussion regarding the hardship to employers of having female employees who may use maternity benefits. One of these students signed her name publicly to her letter, which is a pretty brave thing to do. That student didn't just make this issue up after you were nominated. Last night, the University of Colorado Law School confirmed that she had voiced her concerns with administrators shortly after your April 19th class, and also confirmed that the administrators told her they would raise this matter with you, though they never actually did so. When we receive information like this, which raises questions about your views and conduct on important issues, I want to get to the bottom of it. I mentioned that to you yesterday in my opening statement that I would be bringing this up. So I just want to ask you to confirm, did you ask your students in class that day to raise their hands if they knew of a woman who had taken maternity benefits from a company and then left the company after having a baby?
No, Senator, and I'd be delighted to actually clear this up.
Please.
Because the first I heard of this was the night before my confirmation hearing. I've been teaching legal ethics at the University of Colorado for 7 or 8 years. It's been a great honor and pleasure. I teach from a standard textbook that every professor, well, I don't know if every professor, a number of professors at CU and elsewhere use. It's an excellent textbook, Professors Lerman and Schrock. One of the chapters in the book confronts lawyers with some harsh realities that they're about to face when they enter the practice of law. As you know, and I know, we have an unhappy and unhealthy profession in a lot of ways. Lawyers commit suicide at rates far higher than the population. Alcoholism, divorce, depression are also at extremely high rates. Young lawyers also face the problem of having enormous debts when they leave law school. And that's a huge inhibition for them to be able to do public service, like you and I are so privileged to be able to do. We talk about those things. There is one problem in the book, and I'd be happy to share with you the book and the teacher's manual so you can see for yourself, Senator, which asks the question, and it's directed to young women. Because sadly, this is a reality they sometimes face. The problem is this. Suppose an older partner woman at the firm that you're interviewing at asks you if you intend to become pregnant soon. What are your choices as a young person? You can say yes, tell the truth, the hypothetical is that it's true, and not get the job and not be able to pay your debts. You can lie, maybe get the job, you can say no. That's a choice too. It's a hard choice. Or you can push back in some way, shape, or form. And we talk about the pros and the cons in a Socratic dialogue so that they can think through for themselves how they might answer that very difficult question. And Senator, I do ask for a show of hands, not about the question you asked, but about the following question. And I ask it of everybody. How many of you have had questions like this asked of you in the employment environment? An inappropriate question about your family planning. And I am shocked every year, Senator, how many young women raise their hand.
Well, a number of Democrats raised concerns about Gorsuch's views and record on women's rights, including abortion and access to contraception. Gorsuch managed to largely avoid being pinned down on where he stands on the most controversial issues like abortion, gun control, and many others, citing his desire to remain independent and not appear biased in future cases.
I can't promise you how I'd rule in a particular case. That would be deeply wrong to sit here at a confirmation table. And I think we agree on that, that it would be a violation of the independent judiciary for a nominee to a court to make a promise on any case in order to win confirmation. All I can promise you is that I will exercise the care and consideration, due precedent, that a good judge is supposed to.
That is entirely expected for judicial nominees, but several Democratic senators said they felt Gorsuch was taking it further than most. And in announcing his opposition to Gorsuch this morning, Senator Schumer said Gorsuch, quote, declined to answer question after question after question with any substance. All we have to judge the judge on is his record. One aspect of Gorsuch's record that several Republicans and Democrats brought up was his dissent in the so-called frozen trucker case. In that case, a man was fired from his job as a truck driver after his truck broke down when it was 14 below zero. The driver called for help and was told to wait in the cab of the truck, which he did for several hours, but then he became hypothermic. At that point, he unhitched the cab from the trailer and drove away to try to warm up. He returned to the trailer once help arrived, but he was fired for leaving. Here's Minnesota Senator Al Franken pushing Gorsuch on why he decided against the trucker.
Okay. He gets fired. And the rest of the judges all go, that's ridiculous. You can't fire a guy for doing that. There were two safety issues here. One, the possibility of freezing to death or driving with that rig in a very, very very dangerous way. Which would you have chosen? Which would you have done, Judge?
Oh, Senator, I don't know what I would have done if I were in his shoes, and I don't blame him at all for a moment for doing what he did do. I empathize with him entirely.
Okay, we've been talking about this case. You haven't decided what you would have done? You haven't thought about for a second what you would have done
Senator,
in this case?
I thought a lot about this case.
What would you have done?
I totally empathize and understand.
I'm asking you a question. Please answer questions.
Senator, I don't know. I wasn't in the man's shoes, but I understand why he did.
You don't know what you would have done. Okay, I tell you what I would have done. I would have done exactly what he did.
Yeah, I understand.
And I think everybody here would have done exactly what he did. And I think that's an easy answer. Frankly, I don't know why you had difficulty answering that.
Democrats point to Gorsuch's dissent in the frozen trucker case as proof that he tends to rule in favor of corporations and against the little guy, something Gorsuch denies. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island also pushed Gorsuch about where he stands on Citizens United and the issue of dark money in politics. Whitehouse specifically raised the issue of a dark money group that put millions into blocking Obama's nominee, Judge Garland, and backing Gorsuch.
How would you describe any differences that you may have in judicial philosophy with Chief Judge Garland?
I would leave that for others to characterize. I don't like it when people characterize me, and I would not prefer to characterize him. He can characterize himself.
What's interesting is that this group sees a huge difference between you that I don't understand. The dark money group that is spending money on your election spent at least $7 million against him getting a hearing and a confirmation here, and indeed produced that result by spending that money. And then now we have $10 million going the other way. That's a $17 million delta. And for the life of me, I'm trying to figure out what they see in you that makes that $17 million delta worth their spending. Do you have any answer to that?
You'd have to ask them.
I can't, because I don't know who they are. Mm-hmm. It's just a front group.
Republicans seem very pleased with Gorsuch's qualifications. Here's Utah Senator Orrin Hatch.
And I have to say that I've been around here 40 years, and I've seen all kinds of judges come before this committee. And there have been a number of great ones. And you, sir, are one of the great ones.
But with Democrats now saying they're prepared to filibuster Gorsuch's nomination, Republicans will need to get a supermajority, 60 votes, to confirm him. Or they could change the rules to allow Supreme Court nominees to be confirmed by a simple majority, 51 votes. In the past, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has seemed reluctant to do that, but he has not ruled it out.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 200 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 500 companies and hundreds of thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson. And you know, a lot of people don't know that podcasts exist. They've never listened to one. At Here and Now, we want to change that. So all this month, we're inviting listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. You can do it in real life or on social media, and make sure you let us know what you're recommending. Tell us using the hashtag tripod, that is hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks.
March Madness continues tonight with a regional round in the men's NCAA tournament. The women's tournament resumes tomorrow night. By next Monday night, both Final Fours, men's and women's, will be set. Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst and host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com, is here for a reset. And Mike, remind us, let's start with the men. Sweet 16, not so sweet for Villanova and Duke, both eliminated. But which teams do you have your eyes on?
I would say that Gonzaga, which is a number one seed, and they're playing West Virginia. West Virginia is a very interesting and up-tempo style of play that could give Gonzaga fits. They've never made it to a Final Four, but by being a number one seed, you're being told that they are one of the best teams. I agree that they're one of the best teams, but winning is no easy bet. And then I would say, let's pick another team. South Carolina, which has not been to a Sweet 16 ever. Let's see how far the Gamecocks can go. Their coach, Frank Martin, has brought teams this far with Kansas State. He's an intense, intense guy. He'll stare through you and it'll feel like you're singed. So that's another team I'm looking at.
Well, and are they propelled by the fact that nobody thought they were going to upset? Now here they are.
I think they were propelled by, yes, that's what they'll say. No one thought we could do it. But you know who else no one thought could do it? All the 16 seeds and 15 seeds who lost, right?
Yeah.
I think they were propelled by the fact that if you're going to pull an upset, what sometimes happens is the team attempting the upset, and there were a lot, like Rhode Island was right up, for instance, late. They get a little tight and they find it hard to make shots. But against Duke, South Carolina poured it on in those moments. And that is a key to an upset. I find in these tournaments, if you're going to pull the upset, you're not going to make the last shot or come back with a minute left. You have to get the big lead, you know, a double digit lead if you can with a couple minutes. Hang on for dear life, and getting some offense in those moments helps. Yeah. That was South Carolina's formula to beat Duke.
Right. A women's tournament. Let's see. Oh, that team. Connecticut. Right. Huskies, 109 game winning streak. They won their first two tournament games, 116-55, 94-64. They play UCLA Saturday afternoon. This is so Groundhog Day. Can anyone beat them?
Well, I mean, you're just talking Huskies. What about Baylor, who had bigger margins of victories in their first game?
Right.
First two games, they beat Cal 86-46, so a 40-point margin of victory versus Connecticut's 30. And in the first game, they set a record. Didn't make for that exciting basketball when they beat Texas Southern 119-30. That said, I think maybe 109 will be 110 UConn presumably beats UCLA today. That's the number to look at, that winning streak.
It's great play. But finally, Mike, there's this.
Pitch from Robertson's grounded to third base. Arenado's got it. And the U.S. has a WBC title.
In case you missed it, the game and what he said, Team USA wins its first ever World Baseball Classic title last night in L.A., beating Puerto Rico, 8-0 shutout in the championship game. But I just feel, other than our own Alex Ashlock, who's just been so, you know, pouring over this championship, not a lot of people caught this.
Well, if we knew that the United States was going to win, we might have. I mean, now that the United States won, the World Baseball Classic is an important deal. No, it was a fun tournament, and the players really cared. And Marcus Stroman could have played for Puerto Rico. His mother's Puerto Rico. And in fact, 3 years ago, he said he was going to, but he decided to stick with the United States, maybe because he's a Blue Jay in his day job. So this is like his one chance to have a really good U.S. connection. And he was a great pitcher. Puerto Rico's a great team. They just crushed the entire field. But it shows the excitement you could get in a one-game playoff with the United States beating this Puerto Rican team.
And Team USA manager Jim Leland getting to come back from retirement, which is nice, to quote Bill Murray. Mike Pesca, here now, sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
It's time now for an opera edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. Minnesota Public Radio's Ryan Lohr joins us from St. Paul with some new music out of the opera world. Ryan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
And let's get to some of the music that you brought us. This is Mozart. This is Porgy Amor, performed by soprano Sonia Yoncheva, along with the Chamber Orchestra of Europe. Beautiful voice there. And we read that Sonia Yoncheva is from Bulgaria. She's in her mid-30s. What more can you tell us?
I think she is one of the most exciting younger singers to be watching right now. She, on this recording, Yanni Knezes again is conducting, and those two both collaborated at the Metropolitan Opera last season on Verdi's Otello, and it was gorgeous. She was Desdemona, and it was a really compelling collaboration. I think one of the things that is so exciting about her voice is that she just makes it sound so easy. I think one of the things that's really hard about Mozart is that his music is so simple, but it's so transparent. So anytime there's like the slightest blemish, it appears much larger than it really is. And she has this richness in her voice that just allows it to kind of sail and go exactly where it needs to without any force. And she keeps it really simple.
Hmm. Well, the next one is called Night. It's by the Swedish composer Anders Hillborg with the Swedish mezzo-soprano Anne-Sophie von Otter and the Brooklyn String Quartet Brooklyn Rider. Now, I will note that this is not an opera, but it is being sung by an opera singer, right?
That is correct. So this CD popped on my desk a couple weeks ago, and I just got really excited by it. And Sophie Van Otter has been a singer in the opera world for a long time, but she's relatively new to me. It was just never somebody who I never really pursued her recordings too often, and now I can't get enough of her. Whether she's singing Mozart, Korngold, or Hilberg, she has this way of really coloring her voice in a way that allows her to either melt into the sound of an instrument or emerge from the sound of an instrument. And I feel like very few singers can do that. It allows for this really great effect, and I feel like this particular piece by Anders Hilberg really demonstrates what she's able to do.
Okay, well, up next we have the Italian composer Donizetti. This is the Elixir of Love, Quanto e Bella, Quanto e Cara. This is performed by the American tenor Lawrence Brownlee with the Kaunas City Symphony Orchestra of Lithuania. Quanto e bella, quanto e cara, più la vedo e più mi piace, ma in quel cor non son capace. Tell us about this one.
Lawrence Brownlee is also one of these younger singers who is really getting so much work these days and totally deserves to. One of the things that really stands out to me about great Italian performances is the singer's diction and the way they use the words and how they can almost make it sound like they've transported you to Italy. The whole thing just sounds super authentic. There was no one who did it better than Pavarotti, but I think that Lawrence Brownlee comes pretty close. Anytime I hear great Italian music, it reminds me of that scene in Lady and the Tramp where the two dogs are eating the,
eating the
spaghetti
pasta,
and
right,
they kiss,
right.
And then the accordion starts playing and the two guys come out of the restaurant. And when I was listening to this CD and I heard this particular aria, that was kind of the feeling I got. I just felt like I was transported to Italy and was ready to eat a bowl of pasta.
Do you think that opera in English just doesn't do the same thing for you as some of the other languages that are more common?
I find when English is used in place of German, so if they do the magic flute or something like that in English, I don't find that as enjoyable. Modern operas, though, don't bother me as much. For me personally, there's something a little bit sentimental about hearing the Italian sound in opera.
And Lawrence Brownlee, by the way, is originally from Youngstown, Ohio.
He is.
But he's picked up Italian pretty well.
He's picked up Italian pretty well, and he's singing it all over the world.
All right, well, up next, we have another Italian composer. This is Vincenzo Bellini. It is a selection from the opera I Puritani with the German soprano Diana Damrau and the orchestra Teatro Reggio Torino. Again, just an incredible voice.
It's absolutely amazing. I've had the great fortune of hearing her live so many times, and I think that what she does so well is she is just totally in the moment. She's always responding to what the orchestra or what her collaborators are doing, and she doesn't show up with any preconceived notion, and it allows for this like really capricious, whimsical performance. And I just feel like every night you could hear something really amazing, but it would be totally different because it would all be a response to what she was experiencing.
Now, these pieces that you've brought us are all recent releases. What are you noticing as you look at the new opera that's out there?
I would say that there are a lot of people recording and very few people who really stand out. And these people that I have chosen are the ones who really work for me.
Okay, well, we have time for one more of your selections. This is Mozart. This is the Abduction from the Seraglio, performed by the Academy for Ancient Music Berlin with tenor Maximilian Schmidt and René Jacobs as conductor. What is it that you like so much about this one?
I just feel like he really gets the energy going in this. And I remember talking to a former boss of mine about Mozart recordings and the finales, and we both agreed that this was the way you end an opera. It's super fun, and I think the music just speaks for itself.
That's Minnesota Public Radio's Ryan Lohr. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Here and Now.
The U.S. Census Bureau is proposing changes to the way race is categorized. Now, according to the last census taken in 2010, 72% of respondents said they are white. Seems straightforward, but here's how the Bureau defines white: a person having origins in Europe, the Middle East, or North Africa. So if your ancestors came from Egypt, you check white. Iraq, white. Syria, white. The new proposals would undo that definition and add a Middle East, North Africa category. And that's caused some celebration and some concern. Ara Makhnawi wrote about this for The Guardian. She's a UK citizen with a green card here in the US. She's concerned, first of all, that as the census goes, so go all other forms for employment, for instance. And that's what she's concerned about. Ara, your ancestors are from where?
I'm half Palestinian, half English.
Okay, so how did you feel when you first heard this?
As you said, there's calls for celebration and concern. It's nice to see yourself reflected in documents, and it always feels strange ticking the other box or ticking the white box, because obviously, legally, Arabs and Middle Eastern and North Africans may be seen as white, but the world doesn't see them as white. Mm-hmm. So counting people from the MENA region could help in terms of getting funds for local communities of that origin, tracking discrimination. But this new proposal is coming out at a very interesting time, obviously. With Trump and Bannon in the White House, it might not be the best time to advertise that you're Middle Eastern, particularly.
But again, there's a little bit of pride. I mean, there is pride. Yes, this is what I am.
Absolutely. You feel invisible if you don't see yourself in these documents, if you have to go for other or white. It is an othering experience.
Well, and you take us through how the definition of white has changed over decades and is changing in other countries as well. And we should say race is defined by the dictionary as what your ancestors were, but also common habits, common characteristics. So it can be kind of a loose definition. And you remind us that, for instance, in England right now, where there was Brexit, and part of the upset that led people to vote to leave the European Union, many people were concerned about Polish workers said to be taking jobs. That's debatable. But how do Poles register in the British census?
So Poles are now the largest foreign-born group in the UK, overtaking Indians. And obviously Poles are white, but on the British census, they tick other white rather than British white.
And so they're not categorized as somehow the same white as Brits. And you look at a Polish person and a British person, it's hard to see much difference.
Exactly. And what's really interesting is that there's been, sadly, a huge increase in hate crimes against Polish people since Brexit. And a lot of the way that the media categorizes these is as race hate crimes, sort of then showing that they kind of think of Poles as a different race to white British.
Well, and throughout American history, there are people who weren't exactly seen as the same kind of white. You cite several books. Interestingly, they have the same kind of names. How the Irish Became White. Again, hard to think of anybody whiter. Or How the Jews Became White Folks and what that says about race in America. There are whole swaths of people who weren't seen as the right kind of white.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it was fascinating. Benjamin Franklin didn't see Germans as being truly white. They were a little swarthy for him.
Wasn't white enough. Well, no. If this happens, it won't be till 2020. What are you thinking? What are your friends thinking? Are there people who might hesitate to check it off? This is a voluntary thing.
I mean, it'll be interesting to see what the current climate in 2020 is and the way that Trump's going. I mean, we might all be deported by then, so it might not be an issue.
Well, let me ask you about that, because his supporters might say that's not fair. We should know how many Arabs, Middle Easterners, North Africans are in the United States for different kinds of reasons. As you said, there could be good kinds of reasons, not nefarious kinds of reasons. So why not change it?
The more interesting question, I think, is that why do we have these boxes in the first place? Should we really be counting races in this way? And very interestingly, a lot of Trump supporters are against this because they think that Middle Eastern North Africans are now going to get special treatment for it, that they're going to have affirmative action.
Well, in fact, historically, officials in the U.S. have kind of squirreled with the census to keep whites in the majority. I mean, some people feel that's why, you know, Jews who might have come from the Middle East were counted as white because it helped up the number of whites.
Absolutely. I think people are thinking a lot about whiteness now because the U.S. census keeps us telling us that whites are going to be a minority by 2044. And that's really looking at the numbers very selectively, not looking at mixed race, not looking at, you know, Hispanics, very white Hispanics. So I think that it's easy to kind of keep shuffling the numbers, changing the categories, and making whites the majority.
Yeah. Well, we will see what happens. Arwa Makdawi, a writer for The Guardian and a Palestinian English woman. Arwa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Your thoughts. Should the census forms be changed for 2020 to include Middle Eastern, North African designations? I would love to hear from you at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.